I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Once again, I'm glad to be joining you.
Throughout this podcast series, you've alluded to, and sometimes mentioned, several ways in which investors can add value to their commercial properties. And clearly that helps to produce a level of capital growth over and above what the market by itself can deliver. So I thought it might be worthwhile just summarising some of them here today for the benefit of our listeners.
Well, Ken, I think most of this comes down to common sense, you know, and when you have a commercial property, yes, the market will carry you along and give you capital growth. But you're correct that there are some things you can do to enhance that. And probably the first one that comes to mind is to undertake a quick upgrade or what can be often called a trick up, which is a superficial refurb. So it's not going behind the scenes and completely rewiring and recarpeting and completely overhauling the whole tenancy. But it might just involve some fresh painting. It might involve carpeting, but generally you're not doing a lot of heavy lifting here. It's more superficial improvement to just help make it look a lot better from an eye appeal point of view. So, you know, it may be that you've got a lease that's expiring in 6 or 9 months' time, and ideally, you want to keep the tenant while you do it, but sometimes that's not feasible, or the tenant, in fact, decides to leave. So as you're running up to the lease, the tenancy requires, or the lease requires the tenant to give up to 6 months, but no less than 3 months' notice of their intention to exercise an option. So you're going to get a gauge at that point, and as you start discussing what's going on, the tenant may well say, look, I'm happy to stay on provided you replace the carpet or paint the property out, and in return they will probably pay a slightly higher rental than you would have otherwise achieved at a normal market review. So I would say that's probably the best way to do it. But if the tenant does leave, if you've got your quotes organised and your contractors on standby, the moment they leave, you can wheel them in. And generally, if it's only a superficial upgrade, you can be in and out within a week, maybe 10 days. And even while the tradespeople are there, you can be carrying out inspections from tenants. And it may well be that even if the outgoing tenant has indicated that they do intend to leave during the last 3 months, you can still be having inspections with new tenants, and it may well be that an incoming tenant says to you, look, I'm happy to take the premises provided you do this, that and the other thing, and also I want to install some partitions, so that you then dovetail together the various trades so that the tenant doesn't have to wait till you fully complete what you're doing. Now, things like carpeting is best to go down first and then the partitioning go on top of it. But quite often, some of the paintwork or other items might be better left until after the tenant has done their work so as not to end up having to patch and paint again at the very end. So, it's a matter of common sense, but that probably is the first and easiest method to add value to your property.
Most investors would understand the opportunity a quick upgrade offers with any existing tenant. However, when we talked the other day about boosting your equity, you came up with an interesting approach.
Yeah, look, I do remember that. And I think it probably, if you think of it, an extension of what we just talked about, in that you might buy a property or look to buy a property, and this is probably something, as I think we might have discussed earlier, that you ought to be doing after you've got a few runs on the board. But there's a property that's vacant, and generally I find that valuers will look at a property that's vacant as being somewhere, 8 to 10% less in value than if it's tenanted, because there is that risk and cost of having to lease the property up. However, if you've done your homework and you've got a good property consultant advising you, you should be able to gauge how quickly the property can be leased up. And it may well be that the vendor for that property is a little high in the stirrups as far as the price is concerned, given that it's vacant. But you might be better placed to agree to their price or close to it, knowing that you can get in and quickly renovate it, particularly with no tenancy there at all, no occupant there at all. So you've got free rein of the property, and re-tenant the property prior to settlement. So in other words, what you do is you negotiate a deal with the vendor that you'll pay close to their asking price, provided they will give you two things. One, an extended settlement, and it may well be that the property has been in the family for a fair time. It's a long-term tenant. The tenant's left. There's no mortgage on the property, and they've just decided they want to sell it rather than go through the hassle of themselves having to upgrade the property and find another tenant. So getting a 6 months or 180-day settlement is not an issue, but you then say, however, what I do want is access to renovate the property after 30 days. Now, at that point, they might say, well, look, firstly, they might object to that. And so you say, I'm happy to pay an extra 10% deposit to bring it up to 20. They may require 25 or 30, but at least you don't have to pay the whole amount within the 30 days. And the argument you would mount with them is, look, everything I do to the property is going to improve it. So if for whatever reason I didn't settle, you end up with a better property because I will have expended the additional funds to renovate it. Now, the advantage for you is that if you can arrive at a price with the vendor that is less than what it's worth when it's tenanted normally, but because you're upgrading it, you can get a better rent and probably a better tenant on a longer-term lease. And the date between signing the contract and settling is 6 months. So effectively, you're setting the price at one point, but settling for it half a year later, at which point you will have a tenant in place, and then a valuer is comfortable valuing it at a higher price or setting a higher value than the price you actually pay on the contract. Because A, there's been a lapse of time, B, you now have a tenant, and C, it's effectively a different product to what you were buying 6 months ago. So what that means is that you then are able to have it valued at a higher figure. You borrow the same loan to value ratio, let's say 70%, but that effectively means that you can be reimbursed for your upgrade expenses. Now, what most people do is they negotiate hard on the price, screw the vendor, enter into a 60-day settlement, and then they have to then, during that period after settlement, they have to renovate it, they have to find the tenant, they're under pressure, there's an interest meter ticking over. But more importantly, they have to foot the bill out of their own pocket for the renovation cost, because they've already had it valued at what they paid for it, assuming that's the correct value. So they've settled and then have to cough up the funds. This way, yes, you have to, during the settlement period, meet the cost of the upgrade, but you recoup it at the point of settlement when you have the property valued at a higher value, certainly than what you paid, and probably higher than what it would have been if you had a tenant in there, because the premises is in better shape, therefore commands a better rent, and therefore and on a longer lease, and therefore commands a higher value, which you can borrow against. And so, if you're lucky, you might well end up putting in, instead of the normal 30% deposit, you might end up not only recouping your upgrading costs, but recouping some of your deposit as well.
Okay. Now, what can you do when you come across a poorly managed property?
Well, this is always an interesting situation, and I love under or poorly managed properties, because what it means is that generally the rent being charged will not reflect market value. It'll be under market value. And sometimes the tenant is a little miffed with the managing agent because he or she has neglected them over the time, haven't responded quickly to their requests, which are more often than not legitimate if they're a decent tenant. And so what it enables you to do is to go in there and be the white knight and talk to the tenant, particularly if they've got they've got a couple of years to run on their lease and there's, say, a five-year option. You may well talk to the tenant and find that they're more than happy to stay on, but they just want to be looked after and feel that they're loved. And so quite often you go to the tenant and say, look, if you're happy to stay here, would you mind exercising your option now? And we're happy to upgrade some certain things. It might be that the foyer area, if it's a whole floor tenancy, needs a bit of smartening up. They may even say, look, you know, we're coming up to Christmas. January is a quiet time for us. Look, we'll exercise our option if you're happy to give us January rent free. Now, from your point of view, that's probably a pretty smart move, because that means that if they've got 2 years to run, exercise a five-year option, that's a seven-year lease. So that means that you could still hold the property for 3 or 4 years, and you're going to have a market review in 2 years' time anyway, but they're locked in. They've already exercised their option. So that you're in the box seat, that you've got a long-term tenant, you know they're going to be there when they exercise the option. And for the cost of a month's rent free, you lock them into this longer tenancy, which makes the property far more saleable in 3 or 4 years' time if that's what you want to do. But if nothing else, you build a much better relationship with your tenant, because, as I say to my clients, you've got to think of the tenant as your partner. I mean, they're effectively paying your mortgage. And so you can't treat them like dills or second-class citizens. You've got to always look at them as though you were if it was you occupying the premises, and what would you want? So, yes, that's another way that you can capitalise on what has up to date been a very poorly managed property. And sometimes if you, let's say, use an example of, say, you might have a group of five or six, or maybe two or three strip shops in a suburban shopping centre. But again, the managing agent hasn't paid much attention to the tenancy mix. In other words, there may be in your particular shops that you're about to buy, looking around at what else is in the shopping centre, you might find there's some gaps, and therefore, instead of keeping the existing tenants on that currently in the shops, as the lease expires, you might change them and bring in other tenants, new tenants, into the shopping area that are not yet represented there. So again, it just comes down to looking at what the current managing agent has done and realising that you can actually add value there.
You mentioned changing the tenancy mix, but sometimes can't you even change the use of the property itself?
Yeah, look, tenancy mix is really just working within the same zoning and the same tenancy sort of profile and getting the right tenant. What can often happen is that you can actually change the use completely, so that if it's an industrial use, you can change it to a restaurant, and from a warehouse to a restaurant, and considerably boost the rent. But it might also be that it might be a peripheral shopping centre. When I say peripheral, it's not, you know, the 100% point in the shopping centre, it's on the edge. And the retailer has been struggling. So what you might then say, well, look, let's introduce quasi-retail in here. And I'm talking about people like an estate agent, solicitor, accountant, financial planner, mortgage broker, something like that, that wants to be in the area, can't afford the rent in the main drag of the shopping centre, but somewhere here gives them street profile. But what it gives you more importantly is the comfort of knowing that you have a more secure tenant. They're not dependent upon walk-in traffic. Sure, they want the visibility, but they're not like a boutique or a shoe shop or a jewellery shop, where they're highly dependent upon passing traffic and disposable income. These people have more stable clientele that, as I said, yes, the convenience of being on a street front location is handy, but that's not the sole determinant of whether they survive or not.
So does that pretty much cover the options you have as a commercial property investor?
Yeah, it can pretty much. Maybe emerging trends is something you could look at, and it's probably not appropriate to go into that now, but it's something that you do need to be on top of emerging trends. But maybe just to conclude, the idea of market cycles, and we've used other podcasts to talk about the different cycles between retail, industrial, and offices. But assuming you understand that, is working out where you are in the cycle, because if with the office cycle for Melbourne and Sydney, certainly, where I feel it's going to peak in say, 2018, 19, maybe 2019, 2020, in that order. I mean, there's two ways to make money. One is to buy at the bottom of the cycle and sell at the top. And the other one is to sell just before the top. And we're talking here sort of 2018, in that order, probably around that time, where you've just renewed the rent. There might be an option exercised or a market review you've had in late 2017, early 2018, and therefore there's a brand new, hopefully 4 or 5 year lease, and you sell the property. Now, you could argue if the market does drift on, and the reason for being a little vague is that the global financial crisis went a little bit longer than everyone expected, so the market has sort of moved sideways for a period, but it's in that order. But even if you sold 9, 12, even 15 months before the top of the cycle, you ought not begrudge that, because that's probably what got you a good price. Because sometimes, as I say, the blue sky is worth more than the reality. And if someone thinks that this upward trend is going to go on forever, they'll happily pay you, particularly when you've got, you know, 4 or 5 years to run on a lease, pay you a very good price. So you take your money and maybe step out of the market for 2-3 years. Interest rates will be up there. You'll be able to get good interest rates locking it in. There'll always be shares that counter-cyclical. So it's a period of just marking time for 2 or 3 years. And then when the market turns, as it will, and I'm not suggesting that it's necessarily going to, you know, plummet 30-40%, but it'll come off 10-15%. And even though that's the average, there will always be people that have been caught, and you will get the opportunity to buy some very good property at some very good prices. So in other words, you get your money out at the top and you buy back in at the bottom so that you use that arbitrage, if you like, the differential between the top of the market and the bottom of the market, where you are actually now doing it strategically, not at a good fortune. And sure, you might buy in a little bit below the bottom of the market to make sure you get the right property. This particular one may well be heavily discounted, even though the market in 21, 22 may still be moving sideways for another 6-9 months. That doesn't really matter. If you have bought a great property with a good tenant, good lease profile, and you bought it well, you can't do better than that. And then you ride the trend up through the next cycle. So those are the sort of things that are important, and how you can add value by doing clever things, but also understanding where you are in the cycle so that you can lock in a great price. So, hopefully this has been helpful. I know we have covered some of these things in the past, but I think you cannot go over them often enough so they become ingrained and part of your investor psyche, as it were, so that you're always on your best game going forward.
I realise we may have touched on some of these over the past year or so, but I thought it would be helpful to bring them together in one episode. So thanks for doing that for us, Chris.
It was my pleasure.